Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wash your hands, sneeze into your elbows, try not to touch your face, will ya? And open your wallets, because this flu season, it's going to cost us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 10th of January. Good to have you with us. So listen, sniffles, aches and pains, a sore throat maybe, and a fever. Don't look now, but you could be the next threat to the American economy. The CDC is going to come out tomorrow with its latest flu count numbers. They're expecting a big spike after the flu has come on early and come on strong this year. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports it is going to be a hit to an economy that's not in the best of health either.
The Centers for Disease Control says your typical flu season, and this may not be, costs employers over $10 billion just in health care costs alone. Figure $100 to $200 for that doctor's visit, and much more if you end up in the ER, says CDC economist Martin Meltzer.
For the patients who go to the hospital, you're talking, as for most of them, somewhere between the $8,000 as much as $20,000 range.
That $10 billion figure doesn't even count lost productivity. Economists say an exceptionally strong flu season could undercut an already struggling U.S. economy, and sick employees who drag themselves into the office could make it worse. John Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas.
A lot of people don't just come in to work when they're sick because that's kind of the work ethic. It's because they can't afford to, and they can't take the risk of losing their jobs.
That's why you want to work for somebody like Key O'Keefe, a partner at a small CPA firm in Melbourne, Florida. She's telling her employees,
please stay home, get well, and then come and work as many hours as you're capable of working.
Other possible flu season losers, school districts like Austin, Texas, that forfeit $45 a day in state funding when a student misses class. Of course, makers of vaccines, cold medicines, and drugstores can make up for some of flu season's lost revenues. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The second biggest public pension fund in the country said today it's going to get rid of the stock it holds in gun companies. The California State Teachers Retirement System, CalSTRS, it's called, is worth somewhere north of $150 billion, all in all. So obviously only a small fraction of that is in play here. But advocates for stricter gun control say this is an important step, symbolic though it may be. We asked Marketplace's David Gura to explore whether that kind of divestment from countries or companies or entire industries, as in this case, actually works.
CalSTRS has moved quickly. It hasn't been a month since the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Harry Keeley is a teacher who heads the fund's investment committee, and he says divestment made sense.
After deep analysis, great study, we believe the right approach was to begin to unwind these positions immediately.
But divestment can take a long time. David Weber teaches at Boston University Law School.
Certain funds I know that divested from tobacco, it took them years.
Fund managers have a duty to protect their members' investments. They have to keep that in mind whenever they buy and sell. But they're often asked to consider something else, the social good. There have been campaigns to divest from fossil fuels, from Israel, from companies that made nuclear weapons. And David Meyer, a political science professor at UC Irvine, says the results have been mixed.
So-called social investing started almost 100 years ago.
With the campaign against alcohol, and it's still on the shelves. In the 1980s, the focus was on South Africa. Teresa Gilarducci teaches economics at the New School. I happened to reach her in Johannesburg, where she's a visiting professor.
The people who are running South Africa now, the elected government, give a lot of credit to the international divestment movement.
Gilarducci says that movement gave black South Africans a big boost when they really needed it. Advocates of more gun control hope that what CalSTRS has done will catch on, and this divestment campaign will do the same. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Vice President Joe Biden, by the way, had another gun meeting at the White House today. He said he's going to have his proposals on the president's desk by Tuesday next. Elsewhere in the executive mansion today, President Obama formally nominated his chief of staff, Jacob Lew, to be the new Treasury Secretary. And the president mentioned something that we talked about yesterday on the broadcast, Mr. Lew's messy signature.
I had never noticed Jack's signature. And when this was highlighted yesterday in the press, I considered rescinding my offer to appoint him. Jack assures me that he is going to work to make at least one letter legible in order not to debase our currency.
Talked yesterday about my chat last spring with the now outgoing Secretary Timothy Geithner as well and how his signature changed after it had to go on our money. I got cute. I called it orthography. Johanna Lamps of Smyrna, Georgia, wrote to correct me.
Orthography refers to spelling and other rules of the use of language symbols, but not at all to the clarity or quality of the handwriting. Chirography or calligraphy would be better terms to use in this case.
Fair enough, but I'll tell you what, though. I'm sticking by that dog thing. That's the Monopoly token that's got to go. Hasbro, as we told you yesterday, is doing an online poll to pick a new one, and I don't care how many nasty letters I get. It's the dog.
Hey, Kai. I used to like you, but what do you mean about ditching the dog in Monopoly? I've got a Scotty, and he's the greatest. Granted, as a child, I always picked the cool race car, but now I would choose the Scotty. My vote is ditch the thimble. I'm Carol Scholey in San Diego, California.
It's a little harsh, I don't know. On Wall Street today, up arrows all the way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you don't like the trillion-dollar coin, the idea that the Treasury Secretary can just mint a single platinum coin, say that it's worth $1 trillion, and then use it to backstop our debt ceiling problems, well, how about something a bit more mundane, a good old IOU, a government promise to pay eventually when it has the money, just not right now, sorry. That's the idea being floated by Edward Kleinbard in the New York Times today. He used to work for the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. Mr. Kleinbard, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's say the president decides to do this, and I am a 68-year-old retiree waiting for my Social Security check once the debt ceiling is hit. What happens? How does this work?
Well, the president would have to decide who would get these IOUs, mm-hmm. this scrip. It could include Social Security recipients. It doesn't have to. But let's imagine that it does. You would get paid partly in cash, as you do now, and partly in a piece of scrip, an IOU, which would say that we, the government, acknowledge that we owe you some money, but we don't have it. We can't pay you right now, but we'll pay you as soon as we can. We just can't tell you exactly when that will be. This obviously isn't the same as cash. You can't spend it at the corner store, but it will be freely assignable, and you should be able to go to, frankly, any bank and sell it at a very small discount, because what the banks will say is, you know, that this paper will get redeemed as soon as the crisis is over. And this crisis can't go more than a few weeks.
Yeah, I apologize for laughing, but, you know, history being a guide, we've seen how this plays out, right?
Well, yeah, we have. The guide is that these crises actually don't last all that long. And in the, you know, in the federal case, if you know, in fact, they did send this to Social Security recipients, you can bet that every member of Congress would be taken to the woodshed by his constituents, and I think you'd see a very quick resolution.
Why is this better than the trillion-dollar coin?
Well, it's better because I think it stands on much firmer constitutional grounds, and for that reason exposes the president to much less of a risk of what I frankly would think would be the possibility of House proceedings towards impeachment in the case of a trillion-dollar coin. The IOU is clearly not debt. And
Wait a minute, why is it clearly not debt?
Well, because with the IOU, unlike a debt instrument, it doesn't promise to pay you any money at any particular point in time. It just says, you have, in fact, you're right, we owe you money. We're just not going to pay you now. We'll pay you when
well,
we can.
Well, so I, as that 68-year-old Social Security recipient, am not heartened by that.
Right, right. And that's why you turn around and sell it for a small discount if you're not heartened. And the banks will say, we'll buy it at a small discount, because think what U.S. Treasury bonds or Treasury bills yield right now, yeah. Right? You know, if you bought this paper at a 1% discount and the issue was resolved in a month, you'd be getting a return of 1% a month instead of 1% a year. So the financial institutions are going to find this paper to be very attractive.
Yeah, and so the banks profit as this whole mess gets worse and worse and worse.
Well, yes. This is, again, the idea here, like the trillion-dollar coin, none of these is a good yeah. idea. They're all terrible ideas. And the only question is, which is the least awful idea to defang an artificial crisis and enable us to have the debate we need to have about long-term spending, but to have it in regular order and not through the strong-arming of the process?
Edward Kleinbard is a professor of law at the University of Southern California. He was once upon a time the chief of staff at the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation. Mr. Kleinbard, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
At the close in New York today, an ounce of gold would have cost you $1,675 and change. It's been an up-and-down kind of ride for the shiny yellow stuff the past couple of months. But over the past decade, the price of gold has more than quadrupled. Investors large and small have been buying bullion, the actual metal, which leaves them with the problem of where to put it. And lo and behold, demand for gold storage is soaring, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
By design, there's nothing unusual about the brick building in Wilmington, Delaware that sits near an auto parts outlet and a pharmacy. Inside, the Delaware Depository Service Company looks like any old office, until you reach the vault with gold inside worth billions. The huge bulletproof doors unlock and creak open. There are six of them. Each must close before the next can open, so it takes a few minutes to get in. Finally, the dramatic vault door is locked behind you, and you're surrounded by gold. Stroll around and you'll see gold in every form. Coins, plates, and bars of all sizes. The 70-pounders make a satisfying clink when stacked. There's gold all over the place, but it's not strewn about like in a dragon's lair. Think Costco, but shelves stacked with bullion instead of family-sized groceries. Managing Director John Potts says holdings have grown tenfold in the last decade. Location is a factor.
People choose Delaware Depository because we are not in New York City. Especially since 9/11, that's become a more important issue.
Vaults in traditional hubs like New York and Switzerland are filling up. Insurers will only cover a certain amount per location, so the rise in gold's price means new facilities have to open elsewhere. Also, demand from Asian investors and jewelry makers is exploding, and they want their gold close to home.
The economic development of Asia is just creating wealth at a sometimes astonishing rate.
Richard Silla is an NYU economics professor. Malka Amit is one of the companies catering to Asia's new rich. It transports and protects valuables for clients worldwide, including billions in gold. It has a new lockup in Hong Kong and is expanding in Singapore.
We see the demand for gold increasing, so the requirements for vaults will increase.
Nigel Paxman is the Hong Kong-based CEO. I met him in New York, where growing business has Malka Amit's offices overflowing. Staffers will soon move to a larger space. It's not just Asian wealth driving growth in new locations. At its core, a precious metal investment is a bet on political and economic instability, which means heavy gold investors prepare for the worst.
Now, instead of having it all in one bank vault in Europe or in the USA, they want to spread the risk politically, spread the risk from physical point of view.
Expecting more growth in the high security business of storing gold seems like a safe bet. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up...
We really specialize in those white-collar customers. And never before have we seen so many in need of short-term lending.
Pawn shops are getting a whole new clientele. But first, let's do the numbers. Happy New Year all over again. Stocks reached a five-year high today with the Dow Industrials racking up 80 points, 0.6%. The wrap-up number 13,471. The NASDAQ picked up 15 points, about 0.5%, 3,121. The neatly symmetrical finish there. The S&P 500 reached its highest mark since December of 2007. It added 11 points, 0.75%, 1,472 at the close. Financial shares led the rally. Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, and Prudential Financial charged up 3%. Citigroup and Wells Fargo added nearly 2% apiece today. Herbalife executives fought back today against accusations that the health products maker is a pyramid scheme. Investors didn't seem all that impressed by today's analyst briefing on the topic. Herbalife stock trimmed down by about 1.75%. Bond prices slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged up to 1.90%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Wells Fargo shareholders are banking on a good earnings report. They'll find out tomorrow morning. Secretary Clinton will meet with Afghan President Hamid Karzai. He flew to D.C. for this trip. And speaking of flying, on this day in 1935, Amelia Earhart took off on a trip that would make her the first woman to fly solo over the Pacific Ocean. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Two things to note about the Oscar nominations that came out today. Number one, why do they have to do it at 5:30 L.A. time? I mean, it's a West Coast industry, right? You'd think people out here would be allowed to sleep in a little bit. But two, and more to the point, I suppose, what you saw this morning with those nominations was really just the beginning. Because once filmmakers and studios crank up their awards lobbying machines, a certain kind of economy also kicks into gear. Oscar money is going to course through U.S. businesses. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Oscar nominations may have just been announced, but for some people, Oscar business has been happening for months.
In November, you start to feel it.
That's Mary Micucci. She heads catering and events company Along Came Mary. She's been in business for 35 years and is hosting several Oscar events at celebrity homes.
This is the pinnacle. This is it. There's a lot of money that floats through those parties.
And just about everywhere else. From dress and jewelry designers to florists to limo drivers, Oscar money trickles down to a lot of businesses, says entertainment analyst Robert Galinsky.
It's not just about who you're wearing, but who put that on you, who styles you, what delivery service was used to ship that gown over here.
Not to mention the economic effect on the city itself. In a play on gross domestic product, the Los Angeles Times estimates the gross Oscar product to be $130 million. Jason Squire is the editor of the Movie Business Book.
It's a real great boost for the city and county of Los Angeles. And for those movies that win, the Oscar boost could be anywhere from $10 million to $30 million or even more.
Event planner Chad Hudson says Oscar spending took a hit during the recession, but it's coming back.
You know, I don't think that the budgets will ever get back to the place where they were, but I definitely see people throwing more parties, inviting more guests.
And spending more money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you're in the market for a good counter-cyclical economic indicator, consider, if you will, the humble pawn shop. Kind of makes sense. As the economy struggles, people need cash. Pawn shops get more business. And, in fact, the number of pawn shops out there has been growing, as has, interestingly, the size of the loans they make. Because it's not just the lower end of the economic spectrum that's driving the business, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
This may be the golden age of pawn. The number of pawn shops have increased by half in the last 5 years. And over that same time, the average pawn loan has almost doubled to $150.
There's been a real renaissance in the pawn industry.
Emmett Murphy is spokesperson for the National Pawnbrokers Association.
We've seen a real change in the way that the American public perceives the pawn industry. This is partly due to the success of television shows like Pawn Stars.
The industry is also seeing growth at the extreme high end of the market, though it's not captured on reality TV shows like this one, where a customer tries to strike a deal for $1 million.
Holy did he just use the M word?
It was very cool, guys, but I have to admit $1 million is a little out of my budget.
$1 million is not out of the budget for Jordan Tabak Bank. He owns Beverly Loan Company in Beverly Hills.
We have made seven-figure loans.
His customers pawn everything from Picassos to fine wine collections to diamonds. Last year, business was up 10%, due in part to clients from the top 1%.
We really specialize in those white-collar customers, and never before have we seen so many in need of short-term lending.
In the wake of the Great Recession, banks are making fewer loans. The upscale pawn shop offers an alternative. Tabak Bank says some of his clients need the money for business.
We've found many business owners coming in here, especially during the holidays, who needed to meet bonus demands for their employees. We've had customers who are simply looking to grow their business.
Bob Donnelly pawned his watch.
I just recently did a loan with them for a Patek watch. It was a decent loan, you know, in five figures. I use it in lieu of a kind of a business line.
In Las Vegas, Michael Mack owns a pawn shop called Max Pawn that also targets the big fish.
We advertise that we'll do a loan up to $1 million, but if it's something bigger, we'll look at it.
He charges up to 13% interest per month, but it's negotiable.
The more you borrow, the less you pay.
Pawn shops in Florida and some other southern states are allowed to charge 25% interest per month. Jay Martin sees those rates as an opportunity for his online shop, pawnup.com.
With us, you could pay as little as 2% and, you know, as high as 10%.
The owners of these companies wouldn't reveal how much they make, but business is good enough that PawnUp and Beverly Loan Company are both expanding with new offices in the next few months. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There was another drone strike in Pakistan today, the seventh of the new year so far. The latest in North Waziristan killed at least five people. But half a world away, a pair of entrepreneurs have some different ideas about how to use those unmanned aerial vehicles. John Rossman has more now from Frontera's desk at KBBS in San Diego.
Outside a warehouse in San Diego, engineers huddle over a computer. They're about to launch a drone. They punch in a start and end point on a map and take off. The quadcopter that zips by looks like a toddler's nightstand. It doesn't look threatening, and that's what Chris Anderson is betting on. Anderson resigned last month as editor-in-chief of Wired magazine to run 3D robotics full-time. His company makes drones, and he says in a decade, drones will have evolved way beyond their current military uses.
We'll forget that drones were once a defense industry thing, and we'll think of it as something you buy at Walmart.
What makes a drone, is the ability to go from point A to point B without direct human interaction. It's a robot using GPS to perform a simple command, go here. But it's also a launch pad for amazing possibilities.
What if we sold a box that you could put on your belt, and while you're out windsurfing, drones would just follow you 30 feet up, 30 feet back, keep the camera on you as you did your cool stuff, that perfect aerial view.
Imagine how this could impact search and rescue missions or pizza delivery. These flying nightstands could transform into hoverboards a la Back to the Future or a fleet of mail carriers.
Again.
This is audio from 2007. It's Chris Anderson and his kids flying a remote control plane. It's around the time Anderson started to discover the possibility of drones. So he started a blog, DIY drones, to learn more. Tijuana native Jordi Munoz was scouring Google. He was trying to use the sensors from his Nintendo Wii to make his toy helicopter fly straight.
1 week before I Googled something, I didn't find anything. And a week later, I Googled the same thing and I found this blog.
The two immediately hit it off and began collaborating. Fast forward 5 years, Today, they're running a multi-million-dollar company. With one manufacturing facility in San Diego and another in Tijuana, they build and sell hardware and personal drones. Here's Chris Anderson.
Prior to 18 months ago, I thought Tijuana was drug cartels and cheap tequila. What Jordy knew and taught me was that Tijuana is the Shenzhen of North America.
Shenzhen is China's manufacturing epicenter just north of Hong Kong.
Not just cheap, it's better skilled. They graduate more engineers. It says manufacturing skills that we've lost in much of the United States are still there.
Anderson believes their use of Tijuana's high-skilled, low-cost labor teamed with San Diego's engineers is the business model of the future. The goal now is to streamline the whole process for the consumer. Buy the drone, download the app, type in the coordinates, and go. But drones remain suspect. Many are concerned about a more invasive drone future, with devices like flying sniper rifles or hovering spy cameras. Ask Chris Anderson, and he will tell you it's entirely possible.
General-purpose technologies are incredibly empowering. They change the world. But by definition, they don't limit the way you use it.
Chris Anderson is banking on the inevitability that the good this technology could do, food drops in Africa or firefighting down the street, will ultimately outweigh the harm drones could cause. In San Diego, I'm John Rossman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of a day late and a dollar short. Nobody was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame yesterday, as you may have heard. It was all the same an unusually closely watched ballot because of the first-time presence of so many confirmed or rumored steroid users. Well, never an organization to miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity today. Major League Baseball expanded its drug testing policies. So there you go. And that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. Today, the Dow jumped 80 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ bounced 11 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 added 15 points, 0.5% there. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.